Welcome to the Vanderbilt University Center for Teaching podcast, part of the center's efforts to cultivate dialogue about university teaching and learning among faculty, students, and staff. I'm your host, Rhett McDaniel, educational technologist here at the center. In this episode, we feature a panel discussion with Melissa Snarr, Assistant Professor of Ethics and Society, Brian Griffith, Assistant Clinical Professor for Human and Organizational Development, Vanessa Beasley, Associate Professor with Communication Studies, and Tiffany Tung, Assistant Professor in the Anthropology Department. In this discussion, the four talk about strategies they use when covering difficult topics in their disciplines.
I teach religious ethics, a lot of social and political ethics, and hit about every controversial topic that you can imagine. And so one of the things I tell my students, and I also continue to tell myself, is that there actually is no avoidance of conflict in what I do. And so I have to be prepared for that conflict in the classroom, and I have to prepare my students for that kind of conflict in the classroom. And I really do a lot of work around the intersectionality of race, gender, class, and sexuality. I do feminist work. I'm an out faculty member. So there's a lot of identity politics that are also in the mix as I walk into the classroom. And so I want to talk briefly on two different fronts. One is just two assignments that I use to both assess and then move forward, assess where students are, and then move them forward into kind of more civil discourse. And I think Vanessa will also talk some about creating that kind of environment in the classroom. And then secondly, I want to talk also about the kind of personal preparation that I have to do to be in the classroom as well. So a little bit about, you know, the importance of being a non-anxious presence in the midst of the teaching of these conflict. One of the things that I do in order to assess where my students are as they come into a classroom environment is usually within the first month of teaching, I have them do some form of an autobiography statement that is related to the theoretical subjects that we're working on. And I do this partly because I want their voice to be in the classroom, and I want it to. I want them to also begin to analyze the long history of the building of their assumptions that they bring into the classroom as well. So, for example, when I teach feminist theological ethics, I do particularly. I set up an assignment and I ask several questions around when did you first become aware of gender as a category? And can you unpack through the theoretical tools? Come on in.
Okay, you can be in some place doing your homework.
Yes. Yes. Okay. She can come on in.
Sorry, just to refocus a little bit. So asking them to really trace via some of the theoretical tools that kind of development in their own history. And I have a colleague, and this is actually pretty common in my field of what's called social ethics, of trying to trace the history of formation and structures. And what then formation do you bring into the classroom? And I have a colleague, a brand new colleague, one of my senior colleagues, who does this around race, and she... some of the questions that she asks come from her mentor and one of the mentors in our field in ethics, and it's called a social strata inventory. And I'll just read a couple of example questions from one of her books. And these are, she actually has them do 25 to 30 pages within the first month that they're in the class. And so questions like, what were the stated and unstated assumptions about race in your family? How was whiteness and blackness viewed? Was it ever talked about? As a child, what was your understanding of race? And kind of moving through in terms of, and then one of these kind of powerful questions at the end, if you had an absolute choice without external judgment, would you change your race or ethnicity? What would you want to be? So moving through some of those very basic assumptions, and these don't necessarily have to be shared with others, but getting a sense of what do you carry into the classroom. And what I try to do is understand that those papers are also very painful papers sometimes to write. And I have to be careful when they complete these papers to almost take, it's not therapeutic, but I have to kind of hold space and move them into a sense of moral agency around that. As an ethicist, it's important for me to both see the assumptions and then also see how do we move to the place where you can have some agency in relation to that. So how do they deploy those identities? How do they disrupt those identities? And so oftentimes that's the next step in the next week of class is to begin to talk about what's your sense of agency around that identity formation that you have. And so wanting to recognize that as they encounter these theories, they bring enormous baggage into the classroom and very different formations, but then also not wanting to get them trapped in shame and blame. So moving to that sense of how do you connect to moral agency and how do you move towards disruption or kind of responsible deployment of these identities as well. And those are all built into kind of ethical models that I'm using. But I found the biographical pieces, even though we kind of assume, and I teach master's students mostly, a PhD, we kind of assume they've done that work, but they often haven't. And so being able to talk about that as they bring it into the classroom. I couple that as well with another exercise. Students don't understand that this is coupled, but it is coupled for me. That I introduced in the very first, second week of my teaching, in every class that I do, a process of what I call charitable reading. And the charitable reading is, and actually I have a handout that I give to students, and it's a four-step model. Or a four-step process, and that I want them to apply to the books that they're reading, but also to each other. Because in part, when I'm teaching in such kind of controversial classrooms, I want them to get at an appreciation and an apprehension of what the other person's talking about before they move to the judgment quickly. So, and I often talk about that we're trained, particularly as undergraduates, to deconstruct. We know how to deconstruct by the time we graduate, and we often move to the deconstruction before we move to the appreciation. And I think Vanessa will probably talk about this a little bit, that's also kind of the pundit culture that we're in as well. And so I have a four-stage process of what I call apprehension. So what are the author's goals? What are they actually trying to say? In the sense of it always takes risk to write something. So why would this person take this risk? And so I also am subtly trying to tie that into, it's a risk to speak in a classroom. Why would this person be risky? And then an appreciation move. So appreciating the strengths of someone's argument. And then I move to internal criticism. So we've all learned this. It's kind of in the back of how we do our work, but making it explicit is important. So, What are the major claims that are maybe ineffective, and are there problems internal logic? And then go to the external criticism, which is actually where we normally go first, which is, you didn't take into consideration X, Y, and Z. Well, trying to get inside of other people's arguments is part of what I'm trying to teach, and so I try to teach them that in relation to reading and then also in relation to how they hear each other in the classroom. So those are two, both the biography work and this process of charitable reading that I try to introduce very early. So they're aware of, their own assumptions and then also how to gently enter into the other people's assumptions. That doesn't mean we don't move to criticism, and there is harsh criticism that happens, but how do we do preparatory work so we are not kind of demonizing the other in the process, which is often the easy way to do it. Particularly when you're talking around histories of colonialism, racial constructions, that sort. The second piece, so those are just two of the assignments that I use. The second piece that I have to do is I have to do a lot of self-work to sustain the teaching that I do. And I really have to think about certain classes that I go into of being a non-anxious presence. And that I am really holding space for them to learn a different kind of public discourse than maybe they've practiced in other settings. And maybe they've even had, because this is from my family history, where all you did was argue across the dinner table and yell at each other. How do I, you know, hold space? And I often have to do that even in bodily presence. So if I have someone in a classroom that's starting to get very hyped up, I will actually walk towards that person because there's almost a containment of space that happens. And the body presence for them kind of contains the argumentation a little bit. I've noticed that over time. Or if people aren't feeling comfortable speaking, I sometimes sit down. So my authority opens up space in the classroom as well. It doesn't always work perfectly, but it's one of the things. And then I also have to think about, before I walk in the classroom on certain days, have I done my own centering work? To be able to really walk into that space. Am I scared? A lot of times I am scared. What does that mean? Where is that coming from? And things of that sort. And part of that is also I draw from Parker Palmer, who I just love his work on teaching, of thinking about how do I keep the material at the center of the room so the idea stays at the... Certainly I want the biographies, I want the opinions in the room as well, but I want it to stay around the material, the theory, the ideas. And so continually drawing people back, even out of opinions, towards the theory, towards that kind of work, kind of can de-escalate conversations as well. And so thinking about how do I keep the material at center for the day. The other thing that I have to, especially in my big class, which it's interesting to do this panel right now because I've actually had a semester of where things haven't gone as well in my big class as I want them to. So when I was teaching around critical race theory, there were some incidences that happened. And what I have to do is I have to also be patient with the process. And I have to remind the students of the process that we're going through as well and do some of that work. And the other thing that I have to remember that oftentimes they're in my big classes, this is not as true in my small classes, that some of the lash outs that happen through papers and things are actually not about me. They are about something else in the person's life. And it could be, for example, last time I caught my big class, not until the very last paper did someone, you know, reveal that, you know, he was going through a divorce, he had lost his job, but he had been angry at me the entire semester. And I had taken on a lot of that. And so trying to remember in that kind of non-anxious presence to hold the space and to also realize that in holding that space, it's a little bit of the psychological theory, but I'm going to have some transference that happens in that. And so the other piece of this is I'm checking in with Kat next week to do some assessment of how widespread is the squeaky wheel in this class. And, you know, is the lashing out about this person's kind of own journey, or is it about a larger process? And so having those feedback loops in that process becomes really important for me. So both thinking about assignments that walk them into moral agency around the material, and then also thinking about my own self-work that I have to do to hold space in the classroom become incredibly important for me.
Okay.
So I think I'll stop there.
Thanks. I guess the next week, Brian.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, probably some context is appropriate. I teach first-year students and sophomores as well, but introductory courses into the HOD major, which is an applied psychology, organizational psychology type major. It's actually the largest major on campus. And the one class that I teach just about every semester is applied human development. So it's a developmental psychology class with a strong applied feature to it. So I really want them to get into their own process. It's a course where we focus primarily on late adolescent and early adulthood development. So it's right where they are, right in that transition from adolescent to adult. In the first half of the semester, we talk primarily about identity and identity formation. I present some models, and I talk about the major influences on identity, such as family, gender, race and ethnicity, sexual orientation, religiosity, spirituality. So these are all potentially hot topics that we discuss. So I think as a general pedagogical framework, I go from their experience and encourage them to reflect on their experience, move to the theoretical or conceptual material in the course, and then move back to application, or what now can they do with that material for their own personal development. It's actually David Kolb's theory of experiential learning. So I thought I'd give you an example of how I do that in one particular topic, which is gender, how gender influences identity. So the class is set up as about 100 students. I lecture the first day of the week that we meet to all 100 students. And then we break up into about four discussion groups of 25 students each to really bring the material to personal experience level. So in the week that we talk about gender, they do some reading in the developmental psych text on gender. They read a couple of articles, Benenson, Gilligan. So they've got some framework coming into the topic. Now, in order to engage them in a class like that, I do tend to try to use introductory exercises, activities, stories that will really grab them. So in this class, I tell a little piece of Chaucer's Canterbury Tale, that the wife of Bath. And I talk about this story where a knight is accused of raping a woman, and he's sentenced to go around the countryside and find the answer to this question: what do women most desire? So, and that's a perfect opportunity for me to go to some of the women in the class, and I say, what is it that women most desire? And try to make a playful entree into this topic, and the students really start getting into it. So then I go back to the story, and that is, in the end, the knight, the day before he has to go before the queen with his answer, finds an old lady, and the old lady says that she has the answer to his question. She'll go with him to the queen, but she has to grant him one request if she gives him the right answer. So the knight agrees. They go before the queen. And if you know the story, the answer is women most desire to have sovereignty over their lives and their love. The queen and the ladies of the court are astonished at this answer, and they say, certainly, you've been spared. Your life is spared. Then the old lady speaks up and she says, Your Majesty, I agreed to give the knight this answer, but he must also grant me one request as well. So the queen says, well, of course, you must do it. And she says to the knight, you must marry me. So the knight, discouraged and forlorn, accepts that as an appropriate exchange. On the night of their wedding, the old lady comes to him and says, I'll give you a choice. You can have me as an old woman, and I will be forever faithful to you, or I will become a young, beautiful maiden who will ultimately betray you and hurt you. Which do you choose? So then I go to the men in the class, and I say, what's the right answer, guys? What's the answer? Do you want to marry your grandmother? Or do you want this hot babe that ultimately will betray you and hurt you? So they, there's answers on both sides of the room. And then sometimes somebody has the answer from the story, which is, does anybody know the answer? Think about the solution that the old lady gave the man to give to the queen. And that is, women truly desire to have sovereignty over their life and their love. So the answer is, the knight says, I'll let you decide who you want to become, either an old woman or a young woman. And then the old lady says, because you have granted me what I most desire, choice over self-definition, I'll give you what you desire. I'll become both young and beautiful and be forever faithful to you. So I give them the answer, and the students are kind of shocked. They don't know what to do with that. So that becomes the theme of that lecture, and that is, gender identity is best lived out through self-definition, not defaulting to culture, family, however else roles are constructed. So then after that story, I try to bring that material a little bit closer to home. I show a little clip of a music video by Christina Aguilera, Can't Hold Us Down. So I say, here's a modern-day equivalent of The Wife of Bath. Christina comes out, and there's, if you know the music video, there's these gender battles between men and women in this inner-city street, and they're dancing, competing. And the lines of the song are... It's kind of a song of female empowerment. This is for all my girls around the world who've come across a man who doesn't respect your worth, thinking all women should be seen, not heard. So what do we do, girls? we shout out loud, letting them know we're going to stand our ground, lift your hands high and wave them proud, take a deep breath and say it loud, never can, never will, can't hold us down, nobody gonna hold us down, nobody gonna. So, now in the video, Christina Aguilera and Little Kim, who comes in to sing with her, are dressed in practically nothing. So then I ask the question to the class, let's talk a little bit about the message. What's the message, and what's the medium, and does the medium validate or contradict the message? So hands start flying. I mean, it's a juicy enough topic where people start to get engaged. At that point, I get a couple of responses, and then I have to move to the conceptual material. But now they're on board with me. Now they're with me. So then I present a model by Eric Erickson around identity formation that includes four different statuses of identity: diffusion, where you don't know who you are, where you're going; foreclosure, where you have a strong sense of self and direction, but it's not internalized. You've never wrestled with it yourself. You've defaulted to accepting outside influence. Then there's a period of moratorium, which Erickson said is really the primary purpose of college, to get people to think about these issues and areas of identity and wrestle through what it really means to push through moratorium to come out into achievement. And gender is one of those five areas that Erickson and other researchers identify as a primary influence on identity formation. So I present the material, and then it's a chore to get through the material in an hour and 15 minutes. So I'm barreling through the end, and I talk about social influences and gender stereotypes and the culture, the media and the messages, and try to engage students as I go along. But they leave with a lot of questions and a lot of ideas they wish they could share. So they have an assignment between that class on Tuesday and a discussion group on Thursday. They have to make three posts to an online discussion through Oak. So then they start bringing the material down to their personal lives and really interacting with gender stereotypes, gender roles. I ask them to define what it means to be a real man and a real woman today, for you personally. So they're speculating about some of those definitions, and they're wrestling with what it really means to be a man or a woman in today's society. On Thursday, then we start really applying the material to their own lives. So I ask them to define what the ideal man and woman looks like at Vanderbilt, what the typical man and woman looks like, what happens if you don't fit that image. And by and large, they start to really wrestle with what the stereotype is and how they define their own gender ideal relative to those stereotypes. And it just, my intention is to bring them into a period of moratorium where they start to question what they think the ideal is and their relationship to it. Sometimes it's striving to live up to the ideal. Sometimes it's a definition of self, which is the opposite of the ideal, as a reaction. And by and large, they leave that discussion group, it seems to me, really wrestling with gender, issues around gender, applying theoretical material to their own lives. And then a couple weeks ago when I did this discussion, it seemed really important to me to kind of free students from those ideals that they have in their mind, those stereotypes, to say, similar to the way when we talk about families and family roles, you may have thought up to this point that this is what it means to be a man or woman, or this might be the message you get from society, from your family. From this day forward, you don't have to buy into that. You can define it for yourself. And I think some, at least, and we always wonder if we ever really lay a glove on them, but sometimes they enter into a period of questioning and self-exploration. As a matter of fact, I have a TA this semester who took this class from me about 7 years ago, and she said that this lecture 7 years ago made a pretty big impact on her, to the degree that she made a personal vow that she would never again buy a beauty magazine. And she's held to that commitment for 7 years. Now, I didn't advocate that or endorse that, but that's how she decided to take back responsibility or take back the power to define herself and what it means to be a woman and not be so exposed to somebody else's definition. And I think it worked. In some cases, it does.
Thanks. Vanessa?
Sure.
Um, Thanks for coming. As Patrick said, my area of expertise is broadly political communication, and I mentioned that up front because thinking about what would be useful to you guys, and assuming that most of you do not teach political communication, I have my subject position as a professor in that classroom is a whole semester on two things that they already think they know everything about. They already think they know everything about politics, and they already think they, you know, they can talk, right? You know, so they can send emails, so they already know everything about communication. So to whatever extent gender also fits, or, you know, their ethical positions also fit that category, all of my comments are designed to tell you things that I do that I think can be used in other contexts too, but going back to, for me, the central issue in the class is how do I make them self-aware about their assumptions about what they already know. So with that in mind, there are four things that I'm going to go through very briefly. One is assessment, the other is my assumptions, which I'm very intentional about, which I articulate to them, and then third, my rules for them. And so part of my takeaway is I think it's perfectly fine to articulate to students your rules for them about classroom conversation in addition to classroom conduct. And fourth, my rules for me that have developed after about 15 years of teaching political communication. So first off, with assessment. I have many colleagues who do assessment along the lines of, are you a Democrat or are you a Republican? And I don't do that. My assessment has to do, it's very little, and it has to do with where do you get your political information? Because my starting point for the class is, how do you know what you think you know? We all know something, we think, about politics, and I typically teach this every 2 years, and last fall it corresponded with the presidential election. So the first sort of unit is about phenomenology, the experience of being in a really heavily mediated world and what that feels like, which has applications obviously beyond what I teach, but how things start to be facts to you, right? How things start to be rumors to you or lies, how other people become stupid in that process, right, because they're getting their information from other sources. And so I think that one of the things that's a carryover to other subject matter from that kind of assessment is that it sends the message right from the beginning that this class, in fact, is not going to be about attacking you or your beliefs. We're all in the same boat. We very quickly get into the position of being able to say, none of us, it's worse now than it ever was, none of us have access to perfect information about politics. All of us have only sources that are biased, right? And so we deal with that question right away. Is the media left? Is the media right? And we talk a lot about how, you know, you can find anything you want anywhere, and you can go through your whole life as an adult just getting political information from sources that agree with you. So at the level of assessment, again, I'm very intentional about making sure that first point is a point that corresponds with the conceptual work from the class. Again, it tends to be phenomenological and epistemological for me to break down this idea that there's a that the people who are one political party are just right and the people who are the other are just wrong, right? And that we're all sort of swimming in this uncertainty and there can't be perfect information. And at the second level, to also get them to realize that there is, in fact, content here, right? Because what we're going to spend the rest of the semester doing is talking about the institutional practices through which you get whatever information you get. And that's why it's mass media and politics and not just politics. So again, my takeaway is at the level of assessment, being intentional about the way it connects with the first conceptual step in the class and also communicates a level of respect for different perspectives. The second thing I wanted to talk about are my assumptions. Sometimes I say these out loud to the class on the first day, and sometimes, I love the way Melissa talked about it, I just do a lot of self-work reminding myself of my assumptions. So one of my central assumptions is I'm not there to indoctrinate them. I have political beliefs. I love my political beliefs. I think my political beliefs are right. But it's not my job, and I'm really, you know, I'm really clear with them about this. It's not my job to indoctrinate them, and it's not how I'll consider myself a success. It's not part of my identity work to get them to come to my team. It's not part of how they'll be evaluated. And as you know, there's enough discourse in the culture about what higher ed is and that we're all sort of after, you know, whatever colonization we can do of their politics. That's what we want to do. And so I spent some time with that assumption, actually pretty explicitly addressing that, that they can leave, they can come into the class as a member of one party and leave. It's not, you know, it's not consciousness raising. So that assumption, I think, is actually pretty powerful. In fact, we had a little brief meeting the other day, and the more I thought about it, the more I thought that's something I really wanted to be explicit with you all about, just me coming to terms with that about 10 years ago in my teaching career. It's not what I want to do. It's not what I'm there for. There are other places in my life for political activism. The classroom's not it for me.
I'll get back to that in a second. And then the other assumption that I make with them and talk with them about is that every point of view can be heard in our classroom, but we're not going to engage in spleen venting. That the assumption is that there are different kinds of discourse in the world about politics. And there's the your mama wears combat boots, you know, kind of discourse about politics. And there's the, you know, I think what I think because I've read an ethicist who made me question, you know, and that I assume that I need to explain to them that there are different ways of talking about politics from the beginning, and I'm purposeful about that as well. That gets into rules for them, which is the third thing that I encourage you to think about. Can you be explicit, whatever you're teaching, with your classroom about whatever the conversational norms are going to be? And I just really have two basic rules about that. One is that we do have a protocol, basically, and that is, as Melissa said, acknowledging that it's a risk to speak. Anybody in the class can say whatever they want, and believe me, that gets difficult sometimes. But we're not going to ever humiliate each other. We're not, you know, just drawing the line at basic sort of human rights, you know, and that somebody can say something that you disagree with profoundly. And in fact, that's okay, because actually one of the things I talk about when I cover the rules is, in politics, you don't have a model for heated yet rational engagement, right? I mean, what we have is the TV shows where everybody's yelling at everybody else, and that's the only model that they, sometimes in their personal life too, that's the only model they have of politics. And that's why we don't want to talk about it, because we don't really know how to. And so if we just have some basic ground rules about how that conversation is going to occur, which all of mine go back to respect, listening, providing evidence for your claims so that we get away from the spleen venting through our rule. I like what Melissa said about bringing it back to the idea. That's really high on my list of rules for talking. That you can get away with saying a lot in there, but it has to go back to the reading, right? So it's not just, I've been thinking a lot about John McCain, and here's what I think, right? That it gets back to, wow, I've noticed when on the visual coverage of politics that it seems pretty, it seems to have a pretty consistent narrative. Okay, well, let's talk about that narrative, right? And how both candidates have to operate within the rules of narrative if they're going to be on television. So having explicit rules for how we talk, having explicit rules for the place of the content and the place of the ideas within those conversations. And what's really lovely about articulating your rules explicitly is that they start to exert some peer pressure on each other. And so that it's not that if somebody says something that's patently distasteful, which again will happen, it's not that people are recoiling because the thing they've said is distasteful as much as, well, you didn't back that up with reading. You know, that just seems like your personal opinion, and that's not, you can do that as much as you want outside of class, but that's not what our shared time is for. So again, being very explicit, and I have in my syllabus like a list of six things, you know, here a lot again having to do with respect. Fourth, my rules for me start there too. That means I have to respect them, and I have to communicate that respect, even at times when it does not rise in me naturally. So I love what Melissa said about this sort of just very intentional self-work that you have to do, because particularly this last election cycle, I will tell you, you know, there were times when things were said in the context of talking about mediated communication that struck me personally as either sexist or racist, right, that just hadn't been interrogated yet by the person who was saying it. And so my position as a person would have been different from my position as a professor in that moment, which is to respect the student enough to say, wow, what an interesting thing to say. Like, you know, why? How have you gotten the message that this person is not qualified, right? And let's talk about, you know, the media frame that information came to you from. One of the things I do in the class, as an aside, is very similar to what Brian said. They have to do weekly postings. It was a Monday, Wednesday, Friday class. So they have to post on our discussion board an experience that they've had with media that week and put a link to the, you know, and you can find a link to everything. So it could be a newspaper article or it could be YouTube, whatever. And then they have to talk about how their experience watching that is different now that they read whatever chapter we read in the book. So if you've seen this 3 months ago before you took the class, how might you orient yourself to it? So that they're constantly reflecting sort of on the way that they think about the material as it relates to the messages they're getting. And that's why the fall was such a fun time to do it, because we could have lots of self-reflection about these things. The last rule for me that I'll say is that I have to be also very careful and respectful of the fact that they're going to have fights in that class. And I more or less let those things play out as they will, because by the time we're actually, we've gotten past talking about, you know, how does the media invite you to think, right? How does television invite you to think? How does the internet invite you to think about yourself, about citizenship, about information that you can get visually but not in other ways? By the time we're having fights about whatever it is that they want to fight about, just because we've been modeling more or less respectful and reason-giving communication throughout the semester, the fights are really productive. And one of the things that they constantly say is, I learned in this class that I don't have a right not to be offended. Does that make sense, right? Because they spend, I think this is a thing about their generation, or at least it seems different to me than when I started teaching about 15 years ago, that they seem to be somewhat in belief that they have a right not to be offended. And if there's, you know, if there's something that's going to offend them, they should just stay away from it. And they say, well, I'm just not feeling that, right? I'll just walk away and, you know, not read it. And one of the things that happens, again, as the fights emerge organically and they don't see me freaking out and they don't see me controlling it. Now, if somebody says something that, that strikes me as humiliating or, you know, really... really ad hominem, ad feminine, then I'll say, hey, that's not cool, and I will stop that, right, because that's not cool. But if they are talking about things that relate to, I have this information that I got from the New York Times, and of course it makes me really, really worried about this person, and somebody else will say, the New York Times, of course, they're, you know, blah, 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 media bias is the thing that comes up again, then we'll just play that out, right? Because the truth is, I can't stand up there and tell them with any authority that, you know, the New York Times is or is not media bias. And again, that's not my job. My job is to get them to realize that the channels of communication that exist for all of us as citizen voters are problematic, you know, and that I don't live with any more knowledge than they have at the end of the classroom at the level of the practices. So we stop talking about, well, this candidate seems like a good or bad person because of the relationship he or she has with her family. Oh, well, why are they on the cover of People? You know, why do they do a Dr. Phil interview? You know, so that we get back to kind of, why is this the expectation in the culture that a candidate would have to do this at the moment? And I guess that the last thing I'll say at the level of kind of that rule for me is that there are days when it doesn't go well. And I think that Melissa's point is a great one, that you just sort of have to live through that and feel it and, you know that it's not always, you could have, you know, your rules in the syllabus and your intentionality and your assumptions all spelled out. And particularly during election season, in terms of what I teach, there are just going to be days when it seems like, you know, wow, I can't, you know, like I leave classroom going, I can't believe that somebody at Vanderbilt thinks, you know, but, you know, that's just how it is. That's what it means to be human, and that's okay. That's part of it, too. This is truly the last thing I say. I do draw the line, not just at comments that I think will be intentionally offensive or hurtful to other people, but I also make a big point to them that since I myself have political beliefs, that the rules of evaluation and the instruments for evaluation will not be such that they feel like they're parroting back to me what they want. What they think I want to hear them say ideologically. So I'm very purposeful in the way I write exams and the way I write paper prompts. That it's real, again, it gets back to the material, it gets back to the idea. Absolutely, it's fine to talk about your experience with a text, right? I want you to do that. But let's talk about why it's important to be reason-giving, right? And that you can, you know, make an A in the class and be completely different from my beliefs, and that happens. And I will say, as my anecdote, that I have recently started, I tell them what I think about politics, because I don't think they have a model of, of a rational person who can see things from both sides. And that I was sharing at the end of the semester last year, they asked me who I vote, last day class in all my classes, I said, you can ask me anything you want. What do you want to know about Vanderbilt? What do you want to know about me? What do you want to know about, you know, life and how to live it? Whatever. And they said, we're just dying to know who you voted for. And I said, well, what do you guys think? And it was about half and half. And in my mind, I had been sort of revealing it all semester, just because it was an intense season to be watching, as it was for many of us. And it made me glad that they could, not that they were confused about it, but they could see that my argument in the class is, whether you're D or R, we live in this world where both candidates have to be part of this crazy system, right? So our job as voters is to understand the rules of this crazy system and not to believe that you have the candidate's heart, you know, in your back pocket. So I'll stop there and let it be open for questions, but I hope some of that's applicable to whatever it is you teach.
Thank you. Thank you. And I guess now we'll hear from Tiffany Tung. It's good to see you.
Hi, I'm Tiffany Tung. I'm from the anthropology department. And, you know, in thinking about the topic, teaching challenging themes, what immediately popped into my mind in terms of what I find challenging to teach is teaching evolutionary theory. So I'm a biological anthropologist, and teaching evolutionary theory can sometimes be quite challenging in the classroom. I often comment that, you know, anthropologists or sociologists, or, you know, you're teaching a class on politics, students come in with preconceived notions, a lot of ideas. If I was teaching about protein synthesis, I don't have to worry about students coming in with preconceived notions of how protein synthesis works. They do have ideas, though, of how we have come to be human, what it means to be human, the origins of humankind. So, I'm very aware that they come in with these ideas, and I'm also very aware that there's a lot of media attention to discussions about teaching evolutionary theory, creation science, intelligent design, creationism, and so forth in the public classroom. So so my comments are, you know, going to specifically relate to that, but hopefully there's some guidelines I can give you that might be more broadly applicable. And mine also relates to assessment, as Vanessa just mentioned. And so what I do at the beginning of the semester is I actually do an anonymous survey related to their ideas about humans. And I'll ask them, and this is, of course, is completely anonymous, and this is in a large lecture hall with 130 students, so there really is no way that I could, you know, match their handwriting later to find out who said what. And so I'll ask them to describe what they think evolutionary theory is. I'll flat out ask them if they accept or reject evolutionary theory and just have an option of accept or reject, just so I can kind of get a sense of where my students are. I'll ask them, you know, if they learned it in high school. And then I'll also ask them about where they've obtained their information or ideas about evolution. And that, I ask them about that because it ties into a point that I make a little bit later as I'm going through these surveys. I use that to open up a discussion about how there are a variety of ways of knowing. Because at the get-go, I want to make it very clear to this large lecture hall where, unfortunately, because with 130 people, there's not a lot of dialogue. There's a little bit, but it's really not feasible in a large classroom like that. But I ask them about, you know, how is it they know that they know how they have these ideas about evolution. And I immediately acknowledge that there are a variety of ways of knowing, that that's okay, because I don't want to immediately insult them about the ways that they've learned what they have come to know. And so what I try to do is kind of off the bat validate that that's okay. And then I say, given that there are a variety of ways of knowing things, in this classroom, this is what we're going to do. And, you know, we're going to learn about evolution by means of natural selection from a scientific perspective, right? And so then I really stress that that's what's going to be taught in the classroom. And I make it clear to them that, you know, in the classroom, I really want them to learn about the theory of evolution by means of natural selection, but that I recognize that some of them may not believe it, and that's okay, but they absolutely have to learn it and understand it and be able to explain it. So in this case, you know, what I have actually a line on my syllabus where I say, you will not be tested about your beliefs on evolutionary theory, but I absolutely expect that you will learn what various scientists and researchers have said about the topic, and that you can write about it and talk about it intelligently. So I'm very explicit about what my expectations are, but I diffuse it by making it clear that, you know, I don't expect them that not all of them have to believe it. You know, to give you some insight in some of the trends of what I find from doing this anonymous survey, in general, about 15% of the class says that they just flat out reject evolutionary theory. So I tend to have a sense of where I am, and I just understand that when I'm standing in front of a classroom of 130 people, 15% of them just do not believe words that are coming out of my mouth, that they just completely reject that. And sometimes it's hard to swallow sometimes when you recognize that what you're saying, people are looking at you with a very skeptical eye and a very skeptical ear, which is good too. And my point from there then is, you know, is to go through the data, go through and talk about the way that these scientists and researchers have come to know what they know, and the lines of data and evidence that they used to support their particular interpretations. And so, you know, I can't get into a discussion about the epistemology of how they know what they know, but I am very explicit about how scientific facts are constructed and what constitutes data so that we can make these kinds of claims, and I want to make sure that the students understand, you know, what it is that scientists are pointing to in order to put forward various ideas. So I'm very explicit about what data I want them to be familiar with. We talk a little bit about terms within the frame of the discipline of biological anthropology and those same terms in the vernacular sense. So a lot of you might even have that in a variety of courses that you teach, that there are some terms that are used in everyday language that are very different from how we might use it in our particular discipline. For me, what comes up is the terms fact and theory, and because you'll hear phrases like, oh, it's just a theory. But in scientific discourse, theories are very powerful. They're supported with a lot of hypotheses, and I talk about how, from a scientific understanding, you know, which is the approach we're taking in this particular class, I want you to recognize the difference between disciplinary ways of using the term and vernacular ways. So we'll say things like, you know, evolution is a fact, natural selection is the theory that explains that particular fact, and then we'll look at the data that that support that. Nevertheless, as I talk about these topics, I recognize that some of the students are kind of resistant to it, particularly when we do talk about intelligent design or creation science being taught in the public school classroom. Being an anthropologist, I want to make them aware of some of the larger historical debates, and I have found that sometimes to diffuse hot topics, taking a historical perspective is quite useful, and I think that would be, depending on what you're teaching, that sometimes gets students to back off a little bit and relax, because we're not talking about their school experience or this moment, but we're looking at how people have come to understand evolutionary theory in the past or the history of creation science. From even if we're only talking about the 1920s to that, it seems like the distant past. And so it makes it sometimes a little bit easier for them to talk about these various issues. So I like pulling away from the current era and going back into history for a moment to make some points. And I find that tends to be helpful, and I think it would be helpful in a variety of other topics. I also try to, after doing a historical perspective, even let's say talking about the Scopes trial that occurred here in Dayton, Tennessee, I talk about modern cases that have to do with teaching intelligent design and creation science in the classroom. So after going from talking about the court cases in the 1920s, I bring it up to court cases in the 1990s and the 2000s, and why judges have made the particular rulings that they have made, so they kind of understand what the larger arguments are. I have also even started to cite with the Dover case, which was a case in Pennsylvania where some families sued the public schools that were teaching intelligent design in the classroom. I note that the judge who made the ruling was a Christian and was a Republican. So it's kind of interesting that I would kind of tap into some personal characteristics of some of the judges that were making the rulings, because sometimes what I'm up against is that the students will assume that anybody that believes or, you know, that supports evolutionary theory or recognizes the evidence that support evolutionary theory. A lot of students will assume that they're atheists or agnostics, so I try to give as many examples as possible to show that there are a variety of believers and rabbis and the former Pope, John Paul, and so forth that have accepted evolutionary theory and that they don't necessarily have to be in conflict. So sometimes I'll just explicitly address the issue that that religion and science don't necessarily have to be in conflict. But then simultaneously, I also recognize that many students will always see religion and science in conflict and will always see it as an either-or, and I have to recognize that as well, but still hope that they are learning the information about evolutionary theory that I'm teaching in the class. In terms of having students thinking about this a little bit more deeply, because it's not really a discussion setting, there is a paper assignment where students have an option to write about like the history of evolutionary theory or talk about intelligent design and some of the court cases. I don't actually require this of all the students because some students just aren't as interested in that topic, but for those students that really do want to write about that, there is a writing assignment where that's a topic that they can explore, and I feel like that gives them some space to explore this in a little bit more depth and then also to come to my office hours and talk with me about it, because in a large classroom, I found that most students won't openly express their opinions on this matter. What tends to happen is it happens in my office on a more one-on-one basis. And at this point, I've continued to operate in that way. I haven't really actually tried to do major in-class discussions with 130 people. I may change, you know, in another 5 years, I might change my mind on that. But right now, that's sort of the technique that I've been using. And I find that writing is a better way for me to elicit more thoughtful responses rather than kind of comments in the classroom of 130. Which I think some comments could still be good because I have assigned them a lot of readings beforehand that lead into it. But I like writing assignments because they tend to have more thoughtful responses in that regard. Now, aside from kind of looking at assessment and this notion that I immediately recognize that there are a variety of ways of knowing and that in this class we're going to talk about one perspective and that's what I want them to come away with, but obviously they don't have to believe it. In addition to that, some of my comments have to relate to kind of how I personally deal with this. I think this kind of dovetails with some of Melissa's and Vanessa's points. I don't know if I'm overly self-reflexive about these things, but some points I want to make is that you can't take it personally because a lot of them come in with a lot of belief systems, and they will map it onto you no matter what you say, no matter what readings you assign, and no matter what writing assignments you give them. And I've slowly have come to recognize this. So I thought I would just share with you some student comments that I got in my evaluations from the same. This is from the same semester, and this is before I read these comments. Let me just preface it with: I have had students ask me what my religious beliefs are in this classroom, and I have actually opted not to make any comments about my religious beliefs or lack thereof. I don't say anything if I'm Buddhist or Jewish or agnostic or atheist or Baptist or Catholic or whatever, because my concern was that whatever that label was, it would just filter that everything that came out of my mouth. So I leave it sort of a blank slate, and then what happens, of course, as many of you probably can imagine, they layer on the assumptions. So with that in mind, here's one of the comments that came up in my evaluation. This is from 2005. There was constant bashing of religion and claims that belief in religion had no intellectual backup. Just because the professor is an atheist does not mean that she has the right to preach religion and demean students who feel differently. I have taken many upper-level science classes and am an intelligent person. The more I learn about evolution, the more I feel like there must have been divine intervention. Tong was very unfair in her treatment of her emotions toward there not being a divine creator. And then another student says, the professor needs to stop tiptoeing around people's religion and just say that evolution is a fact and creationism is wrong. The earth is not 6,000 years old, and anybody that thinks that is wrong. Why can't the teacher just say that? Same semester. and so it's one of those points where you can't beat yourself up because this is one of those things that I struggled with. And then just this semester, I got this one. Dear Professor Tong, I want to let you know how thoroughly I've enjoyed your class so far this semester. On a side note, I am a Christian. It has become very apparent that in my church, evolution is hidden from sight. My now slowly expanding knowledge on the subject has proved to create many interesting discussions with my peers and family members. So there are these, you get a variety of responses. And so I share those with you to make you aware that oftentimes, no matter what you say or do, as much as we try to reach out to them, there are these filters that sometimes are impenetrable. I will say I've had cases where I've had the most wonderful and intense discussions with students that are really, truly struggling with that. And because I've kept it narrowed, limited to one-on-one discussions where students can really talk to me freely and tell me about what their parents are telling them about what they're learning and so forth. So I'll stop my comments there.
That was Melissa Snarr, Brian Griffith, Vanessa Beasley, and Tiffany Tung in their panel discussion about covering difficult topics. See the show notes for this podcast for links to related websites. You can view the show notes as well as leave comments or questions about this episode by visiting blogs.vanderbilt.edu/CFTpodcast. If you have strategies regarding covering difficult topics you'd like to share, we encourage you to stop by our website and join the discussion. Vanderbilt instructors are also welcome to call the Center for Teaching at 322-7290 to arrange a meeting with a CFT teaching consultant to discuss this topic further. Thanks for listening to the Vanderbilt University Center for Teaching podcast. Please join us for future episodes by visiting the podcast homepage, blogs.vanderbilt.edu/CFTpodcast, or by subscribing to the podcast through iTunes or a similar program. I've been your host, Rhett McDaniel.